This episode of the Flush Podcast is brought to you by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting map app. Onyx, know where you stand. Today I'm talking with a bird hunter named Randy Herline. Randy's a passionate hunter just like you and I, but about with cancer forever changed his life. Randy ultimately won the war against cancer, but not before it took one of his legs. Randy shares his inspiring journey and explains how and why he continues to hunt. Welcome to another episode of the Flush Podcast. I'm Travis Frank. I'm your host. Brandon Morton is our producer. We're in the middle of January, and the days are now getting longer. For my southern and western friends, bird hunting seasons are still rocking and rolling. For me, it's been a few weeks since I've pulled the trigger, and I'm starting to get a little bit antsy. My puppy, Daisy, doesn't understand why it's been so long since she's smelled a wild bird. We've had a few plans to hit the road and head to a state that still has an open hunting season, but sometimes plans change, and that is part of life. My guest today knows all too well about plans changing. Randy Herline, thank you very, very, very much for taking the time today to join me on the show. Randy, where do you call home?
Twin Lake, Michigan. It's lower peninsula of Michigan, and it's on the west side of the state, about 10 miles from Lake Michigan.
How long have you been a hunter?
You mean back to the BB gun days?
Yeah, take me back.
Well, I begged my parents for a BB gun for the longest time. I'm not sure how old I was. I was probably 8 or 9 or something like that. And my dad finally bought one for me for Christmas morning. You know, I got up early that morning before anybody else. It's pitch dark out. I went downstairs. I look, and you know what the box looks like, right? All wrapped up. It's that long, narrow box, you know, and you pick it up and you shake it. You can hear the BBs rattling around in that little plastic or that little paper container. And so I got so excited. My mom hadn't wrapped it, right? And so I opened the box up and I got the oil out. I oiled it up. I put the BBs in it, you know, and shaking it, you know, and I thought, oh, I'm going to cock this. And I cocked it. And as soon as I cocked it, I went, uh-oh, now I have a loaded gun, right? Even at that young, I knew loaded guns are not good to have around people like that. So I thought, now what am I going to do? So I snuck out into the kitchen. I thought, there's this great big oak tree out in the yard. I know that I can just stick the gun out without turning any lights on because I didn't want to wake anybody up. I stuck the gun out the door, pointed it at that big oak tree, thought, I'm not going to hurt nothing. I pulled the trigger, and I heard a smash. And, I'll fast forward. Later that morning at breakfast, my dad looks out at the bird feeder, and he goes, those darn squirrels, they broke the glass in that bird feeder.
No way. You hit the bird. You got your first shot.
Yeah. When I heard the smash, I knew exactly. I thought, oh, no, I forgot about the bird feeder. And so I snuck back into the thing, and I wiped all the oil off the gun. I unloaded all the BBs. I put everything back just like it was, and I ran up to my bed, climbed into the covers, and I was the last one out of bed that morning.
And so
I'm sitting at breakfast, you know, and my dad says that, and I didn't say a word. I think I probably told him when I was about 50 that I was the one that broke the glass.
That's
you know, I don't know. It was in me as a kid, you know. It was I was always fishing, you know. We grew up on a little lake here, West Lake, and I was fishing from daylight till dark, and you know, I was about as big around as a number 2 pencil because I never stopped to eat. I was just always an outside kid. I was one of those kids that, you know, your mom's screaming out the door like, it's time for supper, you know,
And you never had a clean pair of shoes. Your jeans probably had holes in every knee, and she was always cursing you when you came back dirty, I bet.
And scars all over my body.
That's a good childhood right there.
But it's just something was in me, and I'm an outside kid, you know, as soon as I could beg my dad to use the .22, I was out in the woods back here behind the house shooting, you know, stuff I probably shouldn't have been shooting, like flying squirrels and chipmunks and Tweety birds and all that stuff that kids do. But I think I was 11 or 12 when my dad let me take the .22 out. He had a whole closet. We had inherited a bunch of 22 shells and a 22 rifle from his cousin that passed away. And there was probably 3 or 4 bricks of 22 shells of the old Western yellow box with the blue X. And I shot all of them up. My dad looked in the closet one day. He goes, "Where'd all the ammo go?" I go, okay. So I got hollered at for that, but it was still a lot of fun. And so, you know, and then it just progressed from there. This area I lived in was a big deer hunting area. Every kid wanted to be a deer hunter, and I started deer hunting at 14. Begged my dad to take me deer hunting. I really didn't have any hunters as mentors. I just kept begging my dad, and he decided, I guess we got to go hunting, you know. So
was he a hunter or no?
No. He had hunted with my grandfather just a little bit, but it was more about being together with his dad. But no, my dad was not a hunter. He did hunt with my grandfather a little bit, but if you ask my dad when deer season was, he go, "It's coming up pretty soon." I knew exactly when it was coming, you know.
Yep.
So he took me out a few times, and then I ended up finding a couple of mentors in my life that really taught me how to deer hunt. My dad did take me pheasant hunting the first time when I was 14. We had just a dog pound dog, you know, I don't even know what breed it was. And so we took that dog out, and a couple miles down the road, there were some farm fields, and we hunted, and I shot my first pheasant at 14. And dog
on your first hunt?
Yeah. My first walk. I'm sure it was a wild pheasant at the time. You know, it's, you know, almost 50 years ago. But we had a few pheasants in the county at that time. And so we went out there, got permission, and we walked around, and the dog was just jumping around, not, you know, absolutely not a pheasant dog, but just jumping around, happy to be, and flushed a pheasant, and I shot it. And it went down in some, you know, waist-high grass when you're a kid, and dog didn't have anything to do with it. So I got on my hands and knees, and I'm going through the grass trying to find this pheasant I just shot, and I ended up finding it. But
wow. Your dad wasn't a hunter. What in you, or at what point, I mean, you can recall getting that BB gun at 8 or 9 years old. Why did you want that to begin with? Did somebody else show you a hunt sometime or tell you about it?
I don't know, Travis. I can't tell you. I don't know if I saw something on TV or, you know, there wasn't a lot of programming, you know, the TVs had the remote control was me. I had to get up and, you know, spin that dial on the TV. So there wasn't a lot of outdoor shows. There was one that I watched. It was called Michigan Out of Doors, who Jimmy Gretzinger's doing now, but Mort Neff was on TV 50 years ago. And so I watched that, you know, I think it was every Tuesday night, if I remember right. So I got to watching that, you know, and that intrigued me. And of course, you know, fishing, if you love to fish, you kind of outdoors, you kind of love to hunt too, seems like. So
they go hand in hand.
Yeah. And so, you know, no, I really didn't have anyone that, oh man, I wish I could go with this guy, or I wish he'd take me outdoors and hunting and stuff. I didn't have anybody in my life. It was something that intrigued me. And, you know, the blue jays would fly through the woods, you know, squawking at you, just like taunting you, and crows would fly through the woods taunting you, like, yeah, you can't catch me. So, I don't know.
That's interesting. I remember, I had my dad, both my grandpas hunted. I had uncles that hunted and fished as well. But I also, we lived in this neighborhood just on the edge of a very small town in Minnesota. And my backyard was several hundred acres of woods and fields, farm fields and grass, swamps. And we had a garden, and the animals would come up, deer would come up into our garden to eat the food, and we had to put up an electrical fence. But just like I would see a deer, or I would see a pheasant walk in the yard, or I would see a rabbit or a squirrel, and there was something inside of me that would make me stop every single time and watch. And then from there, it just intrigued me and kept going. So I don't know if my dad, my grandpas, and my uncles, if they didn't hunt, I maybe still would have, because I can't explain why every time I would see a wild animal, I would stop and analyze and watch, but I did. And I still pretty much do the same thing today. I'm intrigued by the wild world, and hunting is just, you know, grown from that spot. But it's interesting to hear your story. I'm glad you're a hunter, and I'm glad that you got to experience it so early in life. Even though your dad didn't hunt, he still went out and got that BB gun and gave you the opportunities, which is really, you know, a huge thing in your life. So you kept hunting then growing up, and then you got married. I mean, how did that journey go?
Well, you know, the pheasant I shot at 14 was the day that I realized I wanted a real bird dog, and I loved pheasant hunting, but I didn't get my bird dog till I was 40 due to, you know, I had to get through high school, which was miserable. Then I had to go to college, and that was even worse, you know, cause they all took time from hunting and fishing. And, but I did find the love of my life in high school, and we're still married. And so that kind of took over for a while. I still deer hunted. My father-in-law ended up mentoring me in deer hunting. He was a amateur gunsmith and taught me a bunch of things about building guns and, you know, cut down a tree and build a gun stock and rebarrel a 98 Mauser and that type of thing. So he was a great mentor that way. And we did a lot of deer hunting, but, you know, with everything that was going on as far as being married and having kids, I just didn't have the time for a bird dog, because I kind of sensed that I was going to pour way too much time into my bird dog and that to actually get one. So I waited till I was 40 and my kids didn't need me. They had driver's licenses and cars. And so dad was just kind of a sidebar. And, so I ended up getting my first bird dog when I was 40.
What kind did you get?
An English setter.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. Well, that's another story. My wife, you know, I said, hey, you know, I started hinting around, hey, I want to get a bird dog. Hey, I want to get a bird dog. And she turned to me and looked and said, we are never going to own a bird dog. They're, oh, no. They're too hyper. So I usually don't take no for an answer. I'm pretty stubborn, but, you know, I try and hedge my bet, you know, so I just kept talking about it a little bit and stuff. And the reason she didn't want a bird dog is she had seen a couple of them that were hyper. My aunt had a bird dog, and it was a field bred, like Brittany that was just on steroids. And it, and my aunt and uncle were older at the time, and so they it didn't get the exercise it needed, number one. And number two, they had a very strong-willed Brittany that ran the house, and they didn't, you know, he was the top of the pecking order. And he would, when we went and visited one time, he would run across the top of all the furniture, hit the floor, and do it again and do it again, around and around and around, through the kitchen, through the
living
room.
Did not leave a good impression on your wife.
Huh?
Did not leave a good impression on your wife.
Oh, absolutely. We're never having a bird dog.
right.
So I started researching them, right? And I tried to, I tried to find a dog that fit my personality and would be a part of the family. And I proceeded with care. I have one shot. I knew if I could convince her to get one, I had one shot. And so we met a guy up in Alpena. I was working for the telephone company in Michigan at the time, and I was supporting people all around the state. And one of the technicians up in Alpena had an English setter, and we were just working. It was the middle of the night, and I mentioned to him I wanted a bird dog. And he goes, well, I'll bring mine in tomorrow. I says, you're going to bring him into work? He goes, oh, yeah. And so he brought him into work and just let him run around in the parking lot in downtown Alpena. And he listened to what he called, and he came, and it just a gorgeous, it was a, what would be considered a Ryman setter. They're the bigger setters, old hemlock, pine cobble type of setter, 70 some pounds, and foot hunting dogs, not one for hunting off of horseback. And so I thought, when I saw him, I said, that's it right there. And so I contacted the breeder, and we got our first bird dog. To fast forward,
fell in love with it.
To fast forward a year and a half later, my wife gave me an envelope at Christmas time, and I opened it up, and it said, there's a deposit on your second dog. So,
oh, bless her.
So my first dog, my first bird dog, Duke, had won her over, and she actually gave me a second bird dog before I even asked.
Wow. I love that so much. You guys you and Duke probably hunted a lot together. Where did you go?
We started out with grouse in Michigan, rough grouse. We used to have quite a few rough grouse right where I live. Matter of fact, there's a little patch of cover just 2 miles from my house. And I hunted that for years. Of course, it's overgrown now. And there's a lot more people hunting it. So, but we started with grouse, just lower peninsula, northern half of Michigan. The first time I got them on pheasants was at a hunting preserve that's about an hour from the house. And I just started looking at that because everybody, I think, that's a bird hunter has that one bird that just intrigues them. And it's like, yes, I love hunting them all, but a rooster pheasant is, I just can't hardly stand a rooster pheasant getting away. It just, something in me, I'd rather let a big buck walk than a rooster pheasant get away from me. But maybe it has something to do with them laughing at you as they leave. But I started thinking about pheasant hunting. And here in West Michigan, there's really not a huntable population. There's a few wild birds in some of the farm fields. But, we have so many trees and so many predators. The habitat just doesn't work for pheasants. So obviously, I had to go to a hunt preserve, if I wanted to get on pheasants within a reasonable distance. And so I joined a hunt preserve, Haymarsh Hunt Club in Lakeview, Michigan, which is just an hour away, and been a member there since 20 years. Been a member 20 years there. Did a lot of dog training.
Did you eventually start expanding into, different states? I mean, I know now you travel a lot, but did you, how long before you started venturing out?
Well, we had an older gentleman at church that talked about going out to South Dakota pheasant hunting, and you know, and that's one of those deals where there's a group of guys that goes, how do you break into that, right? Because I'm a young guy, I'm looking from the outside in, and it's like, oh, please ask me, are you going this year, please ask me, you know. And you know, I never point blank asked him for the first couple of years, but finally I couldn't take it anymore. I said, Harry, I said, if you got an opening, I got a dog. And he says, well, come on, Randy, I didn't know you wanted to go. So the first year we went out to I went out to South Dakota, that was probably 2002 or 2003 was the first year we went to South Dakota, and I didn't know anything, right? I didn't know anything about pheasants. And of course I tried to study them up, but you know, the application of that when it's, you know, cold and blowing, and you know, where are they going to be and what's their food source, and you know, where, how do I find these buggers? And and so Harry and his friends kind of trained me up in the wild pheasant hunting thing. And I actually met that first year, I met probably my best bird hunting buddy that we still hunt together. That's a that's a fun story. They got out there, the whole group got out there 2 days before the second group. Which I was in the second group. We arrived a couple days later, and they had been hunting for a couple days. And of course out there you can group hunt, right? So, you know, they did the traditional South Dakota pheasant hunt that, you know, you get some blockers out and you get some drivers and some dogs, and you push this section of ground, and then you go over here and you push the next section of ground and that type of thing. And so they were doing that. And so when I show up with my other two buddies, you know, we come rolling into bird camp, and Jim, who's my good bird hunting buddy now, you know, he's sizing us up, right? We're the same age, and he's out there hunting with some guys that are, you know, 15, 20 years older. And he had a German short hair that was just dynamite. And we get into camp, and he's, you know, I could tell him, he goes, well, who are these guys? You know, well, come to find out the previous 2 days he had shot, I think they had 8 guys in camp. So they were legally allowed 24 birds. And I think he shot 20 birds the first 2 days apiece. Wow. So, you know, he's in his zone. I mean, he's good with his shotgun. He had by far the best dog in the group. That short hair was amazing short hair. And so, you know what happens when you go in the field and you have your dog is in front of you most of the time, and I mean, even if you want to take somebody out and don't even carry your gun, you tend to walk next to the guy with the gun because you know your dog's going to be, you know, focused on you and hunting for you. So
stay close
that's what
to
happened.
Me. And trust me, stay close to me and then watch so, this dog. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. And then the neat thing was, it seemed like I kept finding myself hunting right next to Jim, you know, that first trip. And it's like, you know, my dog and his dog, they're quartering and they're pointing and they're honoring and they're like, you know, Jim looked over at me and goes, that's an amazing dog you got. Now, I never trained that dog. It was just, you know, he honored naturally. He pointed naturally. And so we're hunting together, and I had practiced a lot because I didn't want any roosters to get away. So we're walking alongside each other, and there's all of a sudden okay, dog's on point between us, who's going to get the shot type of thing. And so that afternoon I just said, that's enough of this. I'm not putting up with Jim. So his dog went on point in front of him, a big rooster busted out, and I said, my bird. I mean, I shouted it, my bird, boom. And the head, you know, flopped back, and it and his dog went and retrieved it to him. And he's just standing there looking at me with his mouth open, not knowing what just happened, right? Because I called him off his bird that his dog pointed. and he says, "That's never happening again." And I think that was the moment that we became, you know, best bird hunting buddies, because he wasn't used to someone, you know, calling him off of his bird.
Yeah. Well, I'm surprised that you ever got to walk in a field with him again. That could have gone drastically the other direction, Randy.
Well, we're both pretty competitive guys, right? And when you're a competitive guy, you go towards the competition. You don't run from it. So
yeah. Yeah,
and it's not about the bird, you know, it's about the experience, and that really, I mean, the birds really help, but that experience just kind of cemented our friendship. And he's got his digs in on me too, so don't think he doesn't. It wasn't a two-way street.
I believe him. You know, a lot of people say it's about the dogs, it's about the birds. It's about everything, right, Randy?
It's
about all of those things at once. If we just walked out into the field with our dog and there was no birds, what's the point of bringing a shotgun? The anticipation leaves. You know, you don't have a lot of that. It's everything. It's all of it together. Well, yeah. I'm sure we have hundreds of hunting stories that you and I could share, but your hunting journey took a drastic turn in 2009. Can you take me back to that day when everything changed and what happened?
Oh, yes, I can. You know, you make all kinds of plans in life, and a lot of times you get surprised with what happens to you. And I'm no exception to that. You know, we all have struggles in life. Well, in 2008, my family came under a tremendous storm of issues, one thing or another. And in 2008, my wife had a stroke in her ear, and you go, that's kind of weird, you know, never heard of that before. What it did is it destroyed her hearing in one ear, and that ear went to white noise, like a AM radio tuned off station with the volume up. And it really messed with the way she was thinking, and her anxiety went through the roof, and we had to get some professional help for that. And so we were kind of dealing with that in October of 2008. And then I made a dumb decision, like all husbands do. They don't listen to their wives. She goes, "Randy, I don't want you to go play basketball." I said, "It'll be okay." She says, "No, I don't need you hurting yourself, because I need you to help me, you know, get through this." I says, "Nothing's going to happen. I'm going to go open the gym for the college kids coming home." And so I did that. I went and opened the gym, and we were playing basketball, and I put a sweet spin move on this kid. He never even saw me leave. And I heard something pop, and I looked down, and I could see my shin. And I go, that's not right, because my shin was parallel with the floor. And then it swung down, and I go, "Oh, I'll walk it off." And I put my weight on that leg. I had popped my patellar tendon, and my kneecap had flown up into my thigh. And so they hauled me off the court. When you're 51 years old, your tendons don't hold up like when you're 25. And so I watched the rest of the game and stuff, and then I drove myself to emergency, and I really didn't want to call my wife. I mean, the worst part of that whole night was having to call my wife and tell her that I'd messed up my leg, because she begged me not to go beforehand. That was in December, and then you know, I got the surgery, and they put me in a cast and all that, and in January, just a couple of weeks later, my daughter called. She was living in Atlanta, Georgia, and she said, "I have cancer." And so now I'm laid up with this big old cast and a bad leg, and I had a couple of cars that wouldn't make it to Atlanta. We went and rented a car and drove to Atlanta. It was a big old cast on my leg, and she had to go through surgery. She's okay now. She's all set. I got okay. 3 grandkids from her. So she beat the cancer, but you know, at the time it was like, wow. I remember on the drive down, I just said a prayer. I said, God, if someone has to have cancer, put it on me. Well, we got down to Atlanta, and she had her surgery, and all went well. But at the time, you're more concerned about your kids than you are yourself, even. And then in April of 2009, 3 months later, my son had worked for a place that he had gotten his master's degree in Spanish literature, which it wasn't fun, but they started coming after him. There was some personality conflicts between him and his boss, and so everything he had worked for, getting his master's degree and everything, he was gonna lose all that if his boss actually ended up going the route he wanted to go, and so we were all under attack. My daughter, my son, me, my wife, and I'd just gotten my left knee back, to where it was working again. I had, it was flexing again, and I was like, I remember thinking, I've got this leg back, and that's good, because I had walked out into my garage, and I looked out in the garage, and I turned around, I went back in the house, and I said to my wife, everything I enjoy doing takes 2 good legs. And I'm so glad I got my left leg back. So I went out and messed around. But that was sometime between April in 2009 and July. Because July 31st of 2009, I was helping my son move some stuff at his house. And I went running up the stairs. And as I was running up the stairs, my right leg broke halfway between my knee and my ankle. And I didn't realize it at the time necessarily. It's like I heard a great big loud snap, and just I went down in a pile on the stairs. And I'm sitting there, and my leg is just really hurting. And I look down, and I go, what just happened? And when I looked down at it, it was out of shape. And so I reached down to, feel it, and it snapped back into place. I'd broke my tibia. And so I'm sitting there, and they call an ambulance, and away we go to emergency. And I thought, this is not good. And they took x-rays, and doctor looks at me and looks at the x-ray and says, well, here's why it broke. There's a great big hole in your tibia. And I go, what's that from? She says, oh, it's from a cyst or something. I asked her, is that cancer? And she goes, talk to your surgeon. And I said, but is it cancer? And, I'm not a medical guy. A doctor's supposed to know everything, right? And she said, and so then she just avoided the subject. And then another doctor came through that was looking at it, and I asked him, I said, is that cancer? He says, you need to talk to your surgeon on Monday. And so on Monday I went to see the surgeon, and they're looking at my leg. They put me in a brace and sent me home, because it was the weekend. And oh man, that was horrible. That brace did not hold it still. But on Monday, I went to the surgeon, and I'm sitting there, and, he's looking at the x-rays, and I asked him the same question. I said, is this cancer? And he says, no, I talked to my partner here in the office, and, we don't think it is. We're going to put you in a cast and watch it real close. And so they put me in a Hunter Orange cast, surprisingly enough. They said, what color do you want?
Yeah.
I said, what color do you want? And I said, hot pink first, right? Because my wife was sitting there and I knew she'd squall, you know. I said, hot pink. And she goes, you're not getting hot pink. I said, so how about Hunter Orange? So they put me in a Hunter Orange cast. And long story short, 3 months later, I got all my records and I started reading them. And I had to Google. I looked at the x-ray report. A radiologist on that day I was in emergency, he had written, make sure you get this checked. It looks like cancer. Of course, it was in all medical terms. I had to Google the terms to know what he was saying, but that's what he was saying. And my doctor had never read that. Or he didn't. Yeah, he never read it. So I decided at that moment I had to go to Mayo Clinic. So we went off to Mayo Clinic, got an appointment as quick as we could. I got to Mayo Clinic at, they took my blood at Tuesday morning at 7 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday. And, you know, they did all the tests. They had looked at all the x-rays and the reports and all of that. And about 2:30 in the afternoon on Tuesday, a doctor looked at me and said, Randy, we'd love to save your leg, but we'd rather save your life. Well, I you know you're in trouble, right? When things progress too long, I'd already subconsciously process this, and it's like, okay, doc, let's go. Gotta take my leg. Let's go. Let's do it right now. I said, how soon can you do it? Can you do it this afternoon? And the doctor goes, whoa. She says, we can't do it that quick. She says, but we'll get you in as soon as we can. So, one of the other things she had said to me was, if you'd been here the first few days, we probably could have saved your leg. But at that point, it's all water under the bridge, right? You can't change history. You just got to say, we're going to go from here. And forget about what could have been. So, at 6 a.m. the next morning on Wednesday morning, they were cutting my right leg off above the knee. They had me all drugged up, and after the surgery, they put me in a hospital room, and, you know, a day later, you know, I'm getting my wits back around, you know, a day later, and I'm sitting on my bed thinking to myself, I'm so glad that this happened to me at 51. I'm glad it didn't happen when I was 25, because I'd had my kids raised. I had been, up caribou hunting close to the Arctic Circle. I'd, been out to Colorado elk hunting with my muzzleloader, and I'd, been to Wyoming, panning for gold and trout fishing in the mountains out there. And so I'd been in the mountains and the canyons, and I'd raised my kids, and I was so thankful that it happened at 51 and not 25. But then the very next question is this, right? What am I going to do? How's this going to work out? I am an outdoors guy. I need both of my legs to do the things I love. And it's like, I sat there thinking that. And so the question come up, if I get to be in the canyons and I get to be in the mountains and I get to hunt again, I'm going to be okay. And that was the first time I thought, I'm going to try and go into the bottom of the Grand Canyon and come back out, whatever it takes.
Well, hold on a second. You're sitting in the hospital room and your mind is already going to some of these thoughts. Did you ever have thoughts of anger towards the doctors that potentially could have saved that leg right away?
I guess it might be a form of anger, but I don't consider it anger. I consider it a lost opportunity. More like, how could you do this? You know, I was raised to believe the doctors, right? They're like authorities, right? You know, policemen, judges, doctors, those types of people, you have to trust them at some level. Mm-hmm. And you expect them to be, you know, looking out for your best interest. And, I can't say it was anger. I can say I was upset that they didn't do different things. I'm a man of faith, right? And being that, I knew God wasn't blind or deaf, right? He could have told mm-hmm. the doctors, hey, send Randy, get this thing biopsied today, you know, day one. I knew he wasn't blind or deaf. So why didn't that happen? I have to look for, you know, what God wanted me to do from this point on. I can't say I was angry. I've been frustrated at times. I've been upset at times. And I'd wish they had done something different, but again, that's history. And my attitude is not to wait around for stuff. You know, don't look back and let's get busy living. You know, that's kind of my motto is get busy living. And so
I admire your attitude on this and your outlook and the way that you're choosing to see life, because it could go drastically different. And for some people, it does go drastically different, and it's all in their mindset and how they choose to see things. Was that day the day the doctors told you that you were cancer free?
No. Oh, no. Having my leg amputated was just the beginning of the journey. Normally they give you, in my case, it was bone cancer, which is, they figured was a slow growing cancer. So they give you chemo, and typically they like to leave the tumor in a person to see if the chemo's actually working, because they're trying to shrink the tumor and make this surgery less invasive and get clear margins and all of those things. But at the point that, you know, that I was at, they just had to take my leg. And then they gave me chemo. They gave me 6 sessions of chemo. And the first session started... the amputation was in November, and my first session of chemo was in December of 2009. And I'd heard all kinds of and horror stories about chemo, and I'd watched people, you know, that had went through it. And they gave me the first dose of chemo, and it was like, that didn't even affect me. I mean, I still had my hair. I still feeling good. You know, I wasn't too sick or nothing. And I thought, wow, this chemo thing is going to be a breeze. I guess I'm just, you know, I'm different than everybody else. Well, that tells you how ignorant I was, because chemo's trying to kill the cancer, and chemo has to be a bigger monster than the cancer is, right? If you want to kill a small monster, you need a bigger monster. And so the second session of chemo that I had was horrible. Matter of fact, the nurse, I remember the nurse coming in into the room that night, and she had a face mask and a complete gown on, and there was no way that chemo solution was going to touch her. And they were going to pour that into my jugular vein. That's what they do. A port goes down into your jugular vein, and they put it in the port. And I remember it was about a gallon of rusty nail colored water looking stuff. And I looked at that and I said, man, that looks like pure evil. And she goes, yep, pretty much is. I'll never forget it. And so they put that into my port, and I laid there, and a day later I started really getting sick. And 2 days later I was on death's doorstep. And I remember talking to the doctor, and I said, you know, doctor's standing at the end of my bed. And I said, doc, give me a pill, turn my insides back on, because it had shut down my kidneys and was compromising my internal organs. That's how potent it was. And he said, he looked right at me. He said, Randy, I don't have anything. You're either going to live or you're going to die. And of course, again, you know, if you're a person of faith, you know, what do you start doing? You start praying. And I can't say I was praying for myself, but I can tell you that all my family and all my friends, I got notes from all over the world of people that were praying for me. Probably 10,000 people. I don't know. But that's the reason I'm still here. It's because of prayer, because I was on death's doorstep.
What was the day? What was it like when you got the message that you were cancer free?
That happened. Actually, that happened 5 years later. I was at Mayo
Clinic. 5 years you went through this?
Well, I went through, you know, six sessions of chemo, and they don't tell you you're cancer free until you pass a 5 year mark, right?
Okay.
And of course, the tumor was out of my body, so they didn't know whether that they gave me the right chemo. After my last chemo session and I started feeling better, I started getting my health back, I asked the oncologist, I said, doc, I said, how much chemo did you give me? He said, Randy, I gave you 150% of what I normally give people, because they didn't know what... They'd never seen my cancer before, the fingerprint of it. It was a bone cancer, but they hadn't seen the fingerprint. So they threw the whole medicine cabinet at me. But after the six chemo sessions, then you go for checkups, right? And I went to checkups to Mayo Clinic for 5 years. And I remember the doctor at Mayo Clinic, Dr. Okuno, he just looked up at me and he says, you're 5 years out. I'm considering you cancer free. So they watch you real close for 5 years. And I had a couple more checkups there. Actually, this past summer was the first summer I did not get a checkup at Mayo Clinic, which was 9 years out. So yeah, it's a good thing, because I mean, a cancer patient never becomes not a cancer patient, right? It's always in the back of your mind, and you don't necessarily focus on it until you get a doctor's appointment in the, you know, in your email or something. Hey, it's time for your checkup. And then you start thinking about it again. And, or at least I did. And so that day that Dr. Okuno gave me the, hey, you're 5 years out, I consider you cancer free. That was the day that my mind was freed up from thinking about it as much. So it was a great day. It was a great day.
Oh, man. And you'd gone through so much. And I assume during this whole time period, you were also relearning how to walk again.
Oh, yeah.
Did you get advice on, you know, options as far as, I know there are companies out there that make prosthetic legs. When did you start learning how to walk again?
Well, they actually gave me my first prosthetic leg while I was in St. Mary's Hospital, just days after they cut my leg off. But that's more of a mental, emotional thing. You know, here's a peg leg, basically. And they want to give you, they took your leg, so they want to give you something back to help you mentally. And that's what it was for. It was so dangerous. I walked on it twice and I said, nope, not going to do that. I'm going to fall and break the stitches open and stuff. So I got my first one just a couple days after they cut my leg off. But, I spent 2 years trying to find a prosthetist that would understand who I was. You know, it's huge. That's the biggest thing is yet trying to understand the patient for them. What is this guy going to do? You know, is he, you know, just going to go to the store and church and watch TV, or is he going to climb mountains or anything in between? And so the first prosthetist that I met, which was probably 2.5-3 months after they cut my leg off, was here in West Michigan. And I walk in and he asked me, he says, "So tell me what you want to do." Right. And that's the question, right? Every prosthetist, you know, basically asks that question of every person that needs a prosthetic built for them is, well, tell me what you want to do. It's a great place to start.
I want to go to South Dakota, and I want to shoot my limit of pheasants this fall. What do you got for me?
Well, I looked him in the eye, and I said, I want to go to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and come back out. And what he did that right then, I'm not a violent man, okay? I'm not a violent man, but he almost got hit. He goes, ugh. And he, you know, his head rolled back when he did that. He goes, how about if we just get you walking first? And I couldn't believe, you know, those moments in life where you go, I can't believe you. I just saw and heard what you did. He was so insensitive. I knew at that instant he was not my prosthetist. I just, you know, I was gracious. I let him go on, and then I left, and I knew I wasn't going to go there. But I did end up finding a prosthetist in Rochester, Brandon Sampson, who's at Limb Lab there, and he is an amazing talent. He has both an artistic and an engineering brain inside his head, which normally those two things don't go together.
Rochester, Minnesota?
Yep.
Okay, and it's called what?
Limb Lab.
Okay.
They I'll try and fast forward. It took me 2 years to get back to Rochester, Minnesota. The people here in West Michigan, for some reason, just didn't understand. But once I got back to Rochester, my prosthetic leg is just killer. They're the best in the world, right? I don't believe there's anybody better. There's some as good, I'm sure, but they build me a leg that's unbelievable. Now it costs the insurance company $150,000, right? My prosthetic leg is expensive. It's the same. It has a lot of the same components that military guys are getting when they run into an IED and lose limbs and stuff. So it's top of the line, and it allows me to do wonderful things. But that was my first prosthetist. I said that, and I knew he wasn't my guy. I started searching, ended up at Brandon's, and Brandon's, you know, basically, yeah, that's no problem. Let's do it. Well, you know, if you can go in the Grand Canyon, you can certainly walk a pheasant field.
And so how long from the point when you got your leg from Brandon till you accomplished your goal of walking up and down the Grand Canyon?
The first microprocessor knee that would allow me to do that, I received in December of 2012. And I started training, and I went into the bottom of the canyon October 2013. So basically 10 months.
Wow.
And you know how you think you're good at something, like playing basketball or pheasant hunting or whatever you think you're good at? I thought I was good at walking, and I was probably okay. But then I started training because I thought, oh no, I actually told people I'm going into the Grand Canyon. Now I got to do it.
Right? Yeah, you got to do it.
There's that time frame between you open your mouth and now you got to back it up. And And I made it a fundraiser for American Cancer Society. It took a bunch of ribbons with cancer patients' names and caregivers' names on my pack and hung them over camp at the Bright Angel campground in the bottom, just to encourage people and also be a fundraiser. And so when I told people I was going to do the fundraiser and they could start buying ribbons, I thought, yep, now I cannot not do it, right? Mm-hmm. So I started training hard and walking the hills back behind the house and going down to the river that's just, 5 miles away. You know, there's some steep hills down there and stuff. And I started training. And that's one of the things that I realized after the fact was you got to set goals. And I thought I was a good walker, but after the Grand Canyon, I'm a decent walker now, just because it pushed me to walk better. And
what challenges did you face in having to learn to walk again? I mean, I have to imagine you fell. Do you know how many times you fell?
Oh no. I used to fall every single day over something that's a half inch high. This is just a fancy hinge, right? Of everything that prosthetics are, and they're wonderful, right? And they're expensive, but everything they are, it's just a fancy hinge. And, it's maybe 10% of your God-given leg, this $150,000 leg, but it's a million times better than crutches or a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. So, how many times did I fall? Well, I used to fall every day, and then I'd fall every other day. And right now, hunting season's done. So I probably only fall 2 times a week right now, but I'm doing stupid stuff too, right? I go up a 30-foot ladder to clean out my gutters. And yeah. I crawl up on top of my Lance camper to treat the roof and make sure everything's sealed up. I do stupid stuff yet, but
that's not stupid. You're living life. You're back to living life again. Yeah, yeah. That's not stupid at all.
Yeah, don't lose your identity, right? Don't lose who you are. Mm-hmm. They might cut your leg off, but don't lose who you are. And so. I kept track one year. I went out to South Dakota with Jim and a couple of other buddies. And of course, waist-high grass, knee-high grass, it's problematic because you're basically dragging your leg through it. Your toe catches on everything. And so you try and walk on the deer trails and you try and walk on, two tracks once in a while. I don't care for section lines so much because of the barbed wire. It tears your dog up. Mm-hmm. But that one trip to South Dakota, I fell right around, I stopped counting in the 90s. And I'm sure I fell more than 100 times that 1 week in South Dakota pheasant hunting.
The first time you hunted again?
No, that was probably the fourth or fifth trip after I got my prosthetic leg. I used to hunt off my ATV. I have a permit to hunt off an ATV for South Dakota. And so I can shoot pheasants sitting on my ATV. But you can only be on private land. You cannot be in the walk-in areas. You cannot be mm-hmm. on any public or public leased land. So all of those public areas or walk-in areas, I couldn't use my ATV. And I really never wanted to hunt off my ATV. I just don't like that. I want to have my shotgun and my dog, and I just want to be outdoors in the outdoors quiet, and watch my dog. And to have an ATV going putt, 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 it just, there was something not right with that. And so I hunted off my ATV 2 years. The third year, I took it out there, but I never took it off the truck. And since then, you know, the last, whatever, 7-8 years, I haven't hunted off my ATV at all. I would do all my hunting off my leg. It's not easy, but we seem to shoot a pheasant once in a while.
Yeah. I have a handful more questions for you, but first I have a message from our presenting sponsor, Onyx. They help us to make this podcast possible. Besides my shotgun, shells, boots, and dog, the Onyx Hunt app is the most helpful tool that I bring into the field. I use it every day that I go hunting, and my library of information keeps on growing. The Onyx app gives me the information that I need to stay on the property that I have permission to hunt. It also shows me land boundaries, both public and private, and shows exactly where I'm standing while in the field. It is a huge tool when I'm traveling to new areas because I hunt a lot of public land and I can zoom way out and look at entire counties or regions and see the different colored dots on the map that indicate public lands like WMAs, WPAs, or walk-in access. Then I zoom in for a closer look and I dissect the property and make a game plan. I can also download offline maps and use the app even when my cell phone doesn't have any service. I know a few of the techs at Onyx, and they continue to ask me what we can do to improve the app, and they're adding features that will help you in the field, features like forecasts and wind directions for the property that you're going to hunt. Basically, my Onyx app has become a living journal that I continue to use and will continue to use for years to come. If you haven't tried the Onyx Hunt app, I highly recommend you download it before your next hunting adventure. They give you a free trial, so you'll be able to test it out while on the road. My guess is that you'll become a lifelong user like me and all of my hunting buddies. Onyx Maps, they help you to know where you stand. Randy, you now hunt on a lot of public lands. Have you ever used the Onyx Hunt app?
Oh, I love it. Yes. I'm Dutch, so I'm pretty frugal, right? But I got Onyx this fall for the first time. Oh my goodness. There just are no words. It's one of those things where if you're a hunter, right, you always, in the back of your mind, you think, okay, am I following the laws? Yes or no? Yes, because I don't, you know, you don't want to be looking over your shoulder, right? You're out there to have fun and enjoy the outdoors and stuff. Well, Onyx took away that thing in the back of my head that said, are you on private or public? Should you be here? Is there a landowner gonna, you know, come holler at you and call the conservation officer? That little cloud that you have to have in the back of your mind when you don't have Onyx is gone. It's like, as soon as you think, am I on private or public? You whip out your phone, you go, ah, good. Look at, I got all this in front of me. I can hunt. And you put it out of your mind and you just have a great time and you don't have to worry about whether you're on private or public. And the other thing I love, we went out to Iowa this past fall, Jim and I. We hunted. We did a lot of scouting. And how do I say it? Your first trip out somewhere doesn't necessarily always pay off in number of birds because you're learning it. And it was the first time we were up there. And so we found a few good spots and I marked them on my Onyx hunt maps.
Yep.
You know, the waypoints, and I named them and, oh, this looks good. And, oh, there's corn over here and there's cover over here and all that. And we came back home and it was so good in Iowa, right? The last 2 days that we were there, it was so good. We had found so many good areas that I had them all on my phone, right? But it's time to go home. So we came home. Well, Jim and his son went out a few weeks later, and his son has it, and Jim has it. I think most all my hunting buddies have it now because Ryan, his son, goes, hey, Randy, can you send me those waypoints where you guys hunted? So I just sent them to him. Mm-hmm. And that is a beautiful feature.
It is. It really is. It's changed for my friends and I. I mean, it's changed the way that we hunt, the information that we can share. Like I said, it's like a living journal of information. And depending on the birds that you hunt, let's say you're in Montana or you're in northern North Dakota and you're hunting sharp-tailed grouse, if that ground doesn't get broken, nothing will change. Shouldn't change the fact that if you find coveys of birds in a specific area, you should be able to come back for years and years. Decades could go by, and that pin should put you into a promising area.
And really?
Yes. I mean, it's interesting. Crops can change, grass can change, you know, in some of the pheasant areas. Obviously, the woods can change for grouse, you know, for rough grouse and where they may be. But prairie birds, if the ground isn't broken, they should, that spot should be a spot. And with quail, you know, I mean, I think as hunters, we need to be responsible about it too. But even with quail, you find a covey, I mean, you're bound down to Oklahoma, could send you 25 pins, and now you know where 25 coveys of quail are. And so as hunters, we need to be responsible and say, I don't want to, nobody wants to wipe out a covey of birds, no matter where you hunt. But the reality is, that app, and I know we're talking a lot about Onyx right now, but for good reason, because that app can really, really change how successful you are as a hunter in the way that you approach it. And you mentioned something about looking into your phone. I do it often when I'm walking in the field. And there are times where I'm like, something doesn't feel right. Like, the grass is the same. There's no fence. There's no markings. I can't see a sign. But I feel like, did I go too far? And I'll pull it out and I'll be like, holy cow, I'm 20 feet over the line. And there's no way I would have known that if I didn't look. The other thing I have is I've got one of their memory cards, and I put it in my handheld remote so I can see Daisy, my dog, running, and I can see if she crosses the invisible lines into private land, and I just tap the button 3 times and she turns and comes right back to me. It's a beautiful tool. Beautiful tool.
Wow.
I absolutely love it. Yeah.
I didn't know about that feature.
I want to get back in. Yeah, it's really good. I highly recommend doing a little bit of searching, especially because you don't want your dog 300 yards over somebody else's property, right? I mean,
right.
you know, so it really, really is a helpful hunting tool all the way around. Randy, where did you hunt this year?
The Upper Peninsula of Michigan for rough grouse.
Okay.
And my out west trip was to Iowa. We went out early, I think it was the second weekend of pheasant season, to Iowa, because we had seen that the hunter numbers had been declining and the harvest is going up, which means there's more birds than ever there. So yep. We thought, oh, we're going to try Iowa. So we did that early season. We had plans to maybe go out and see Tyler in North Dakota. But due to a few situations, one of my dogs, I had to put one of my dogs down.
Oh,
and
no.
And the second one was getting sick. So I knew a North Dakota trip was out for me. And that's why Jim and Ryan went back to Iowa, because it was so good out there. But I hunt local. You know, I did grouse hunts local here in West Michigan. And I guided a couple of times over at the hunt preserve that I belong to. So that's about the hunting that I did this year.
What you say you guide. So what do people say to you when they see you walking the fields and they know that you only have one leg?
Most people are really uncomfortable, right? And
really?
And of course, the owner or the manager of the hunt club, you know, knows I have a fake leg, right? And mm-hmm. So he doesn't give me necessary. Well, I've had 4 young guys that could, you know, walk any mountain range you wanted to walk, and then I guided for them, but they shot 33 birds that day off of my dogs, but for the most part, people, I don't know that they even tell them that I have a fake leg. I just jump out of the truck, you know, and just act like nothing's different. And we go hunt. And quite often it's after the hunt, they go, wow, that's amazing. You get around like you do. And when I guide, I have my walking sticks with me, right? Because I'm not carrying a gun. And the walking sticks really help as well, because you can clear brush out of the way and keep your catch your balance. And but they usually are amazed that I'm still out pheasant hunting.
Your hashtag,
but I think they're more impressed with my dogs, Travis. At least I want to believe that, right?
I bet they leave inspired. I really do. I mean, I can't imagine how somebody couldn't. I really can't. So what kind of dogs do you have right now?
It's a Ryman setter, an English setter. The Ryman, leaning mm-hmm. towards the Ryman breeding.
Okay.
They're, you know, he's 72 pounds when he's healthy, and he can run all day, and his range is, it'll be, you know, he quarters more than going, you know, he's not one of those straight line dogs that just runs away from you. He quarters most of the time, and he's usually 20 to 50, 60 yards, depending on the cover. If the cover gets pretty sparse, you know, he's like any dog. He's like, hey, Dad, there ain't no birds around here. There's no cover. Oh, look at that bush out there at 100 yards. I'm going to go sniff over there. And so he does that. But he's a foot hunting English setter. And, you know, he ranges 20 to 50 yards, 60 yards most of the time.
I usually track how far I walk in a day. There's some days where I'll go over 20 miles. How far is the furthest you've walked on a hunt?
The furthest I've walked was 8.5 miles. I never checked, right, until I got my latest dog collars. I use an app on my phone. Number one, the chemo killed my ears, so I can't hear a beeper. I can't hear a fire alarm in the house. It killed all the high frequencies. And so those old beepers that I had, those high beepers, I couldn't hear them. I bought a low-tone beeper. That didn't work either. And so I ended up getting an app on my phone with my collars that my phone tells me, Lincoln's pointing, right? And I can hear that, and it tells me the direction in that. So I could check. I think the furthest I walked was 8.5 miles with that app. And I think my dog put on, 15, 16 that day.
Your hashtag on social media is the Wandering Amputee. Why do you post about your life now and let people know about your hunting on one leg?
I want to encourage people. You know, things in life happen. And I'm no exception. And, you know, when you're young, you think, you know, you're going to have a perfect life, perfect kids, perfect wife, perfect life. And, that just isn't reality. So, the Wandering Amputee, you know, it was just another avenue to try and encourage people that, hey, stuff happens, but you can still do things. And you don't have to be a victim. And even though bad things have happened to you, you don't have to be a victim. So get busy living. And that was the Wandering Amputee Instagram account was to do that. And hopefully people are a little bit encouraged by it.
Are you hearing from people? Do you get feedback from people that know your story and how you've pushed through and what you're doing today?
New people that I get to know, yes, I get some feedback from them, but the people that have been around me for the last 5 or 10 years, they every once in a while they'll go, oh, I'm sorry, Randy, I forgot you had a fake leg. And that's the best compliment, right? Mm-hmm. If the people next to you forget, then things are going good. And you know, my new acquaintances, you know, what I found is through my Instagram, it's amputees, it's brand new amputees that reach out to me and say, thank you. I thought my life was over. But I know it isn't. So, I do get, you know, I think I am having a little bit of encouragement towards people, but primarily new amputees and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. You give presentations?
I do. Every once in a while, typically it's a wild game dinner at a church, local church or whatever that, you know, they want to encourage people and they invite the community in and provide a great wild meal dinner and, wild game dinner. And so I'll go and I'll talk to them about my journey, you know, who I was. You know, I used to run triathlons and I, you know, was outdoors and, you know, climbing all over mountains and canyons. And then I tell them my story, the story which I've told you today. And they're like, well, wow, how's it going now? You know? And so then I go into that too. And that, hey, life is good. Life is good.
You're still climbing mountains. You're still hunting. You're still doing everything you did before. But you have a chapter in your life that you powered through. And now, because of that, you're able to talk to people and have an effect on them because you've lived it, right? I mean, that's the biggest thing is you've lived it. You lived through it. You kept your faith. And you came out the other side on that.
Yep. That's, you know, one of the things I think about is, yeah, everybody has some type of faith, right? Faith in that your car is going to start, or faith in God, or faith, you know, there's faith involved in everything you do every day. And, you know, yeah, my faith is still strong. Just because I hit a few bumps in the road, you know, it didn't change my faith one bit. So, did I like it? Heck no. You know, every once in a while, I tell my wife, I go, you know, I'm not questioning God, but yeah, I wouldn't mind having my good, healthy leg back. no, you know, people have to decide, you know, what they believe in and how they're going to live their life. And it all takes faith. So it's just a matter of what your faith is in. And my faith is in God. And I know my eternity is secure, and this whole thing is just a bump in the road, whether you have your both normal legs or not.
And how's your wife doing?
Pardon?
How's your wife doing?
She's been good. That's a loaded question, Travis.
Is her health well?
You know how opposites attract, right?
Yeah.
I've been married to her.
Up here.
I've been married to her 42 years, so she's good. She's good.
Good.
Yeah.
Glad to hear that.
Yeah, my son's good. My daughter's great. My wife's great. And my dog situation isn't so great, but I just put a deposit in for a new puppy, so we're going to have that whole bit of fun again.
There's a lot of hunts on your horizon, I can hear. What goals do you still have left to complete now?
Well, I would still like to do my retirement goal of finding the first quail season that opens up somewhere in the United States, meaning whether it's Washington, Oregon, you know, wherever. And I wanted to follow the quail seasons and hunt and hopefully shoot at least one of each quail in the United States. That's kind of problematic now because of my situation, but I'm still thinking about that. And I may do that next fall. Because I know, you know, every year that goes by, you get less and less ability to do that type of thing. Is I'm 62 now, so I gotta do it sooner than later. So maybe next year we'll do that quail grand slam type of thing. Still like to go out and visit Tyler out in North Dakota. Sharp tails. I may want my ATV for sharp tail hunting, right?
No way. No, you don't get to do that. You got to do it the way that everyone else has to do it.
No, wait a minute. If it's legal. No, I did think of that when I had two, I remember hunting off my ATV and my two English setters were healthy. And we went across the guys were going to go to the other corner of the section and I didn't want to load up my ATV. So I was going to take off on a diagonal, right? And I ran my dogs for about, we ran into a fence. We almost got to the other corner and we ran into a fence. And so I'm on an ATV, so I got to go find a gate. And by the time we were done, my dogs had run about 4 miles. And I thought, man, I got to give them a break. So I stopped my ATV and they're just looking at me like, come on, let's go hunt, you know, and they're doing the snow angels and come on, barking, let's go. Like they hadn't run at all. So I thought at that time, I thought, you know what? I could probably really get after the sharp tails on my ATV with my two English setters. I never did it.
Yeah, but you probably could do some damage out there. you know, you mentioned earlier about the Grand Canyon, and once you told people that that was a goal of yours, you had to stick with it. You just told us that your goal, you've been thinking about it, is to follow the quail season through the country. So people know about it now, Randy. You're going to have to stick to it.
Well, you're going to go with?
Oh, I never liked you.
That was, I'm sorry, Travis. I'll retract that question. That's unfair.
No, let's leave it on the table. There's a couple of quail species on my list yet that I have not harvested. So we'll talk. We'll keep in touch. I know goals are important. You've set them. Why do you feel it's so important to set goals for yourself? I mean, for people listening right now, what do goals in life do for you?
Well, what it does is it breaks you out of your normal mindset and it breaks you out of your normal routine. It just makes you a better person. It makes you more effective at the things that you do, whether it's things you don't like to do or things you do like to do. Most of the people I know don't want to get up and train for an hour, hour and a half, so that they can go elk hunting. But a dyed-in-the-wool elk hunter knows he's got to do it. Well, when you set those goals, it's going to make you a better person. Even if you don't get there, I often have new amputees, right? I have a doctor at Mayo Clinic that calls me and says, can I give your name to a patient that I have? He's pretty discouraged and he needs some encouragement. And I said, absolutely. And when I talked to them, that's what I talked to one person. He had just gotten his leg cut off. And I said, Chuck, you gotta set yourself goals. And I said, even if it's just going to the mailbox, set a goal. And then when you've been going to the mailbox for a month, set another goal, you know, walk down to the coffee shop, you know, it's only a mile away, walk down to the coffee shop, have a coffee and come back. And then after a month of that, set yourself another goal. And I said, you got to set goals and at least try to accomplish them.
Are you available if somebody listening right now wants to reach out to you and talk more, or maybe they know somebody that's going through a hard time and they could use, maybe it's inspiration or just advice. Are you available? Where can somebody reach out to you?
Oh, they can find me on Facebook, just Randy Herline in West Michigan, or they can find me, at the Wandering Amputee on Instagram, you know, send me a message and I'll share my number with you and we can talk. Absolutely. The most important thing I can do is encourage people. I love pheasant hunting and a lot of different things in life, but I really, really would love to talk with them just to let them know, you know, it's going to get better.
Last question, and you maybe have already answered this multiple times, but your journey that you've gone through in life, what's the most important thing you've learned along the way?
Wow, Travis. the most important thing was that my faith is real. There was a lot of opportunities for me to get mad at God or to turn my back on him or to lose my faith. And none of that happened. There was none of that tendency at all. And so they say that you don't know your faith is real until it's tested. I know my faith is real because it has been tested, and I would not trade that for a good leg. So that's the most important thing. My faith is real.
Powerful. It's very powerful. Randy, thank you for sharing your story with us today. I really appreciate it. I wish you well on your next quail hunting goal of knocking every one of them off of the list. And I hope someday I can walk a field alongside you. It would be a true honor for me. So thank you.
Oh, I'd love. I actually want to just hunt with Daisy, Travis.
Hey, you know what? You remember I won't get it. That's a whole nother story. Next season, she is going to be, she's already a rock star. I'll say that. She's already a rock star, but she's taught me so much about life, about myself. I've learned, and she's also learned to go hunting with me too. It's a beautiful thing. So we're all on our own journeys, but we can all learn from each other. There's no doubt about that.
Randy, love to hunt with you.
We'll stay in touch, absolutely. Once again, thank you to Onyx Hunt for helping us to make this show possible. Don't forget to download the Onyx Hunt app onto your phone before your next hunting adventure to help you find those pieces of property that are open to the public and full of wild birds. Current episodes of the Flush television show are streaming now on our YouTube channel. A new full-length episode uploads each and every Tuesday from now through the end of March. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel and you'll never miss an upload. Thank you for following our journey through the uplands. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Flush Podcast.